many hurdles to achieve, like paying the rent for both the transmitter as well as the facilities here at 388 Atlantic Avenue. But it's also the ability to communicate with each other and to understand that we have to have each other's backs. Meaning that if the listeners have our backs, then that needs to be reciprocated, okay? So I'm just saying is that there is room for improvement. And with that said, that doesn't mean that I'm calling out anyone, okay? Because anytime when I go and talk like this, real talk to the listeners out there, there will be an individual or two that will immediately call management and saying, Reggie's saying something about y'all. And I'm like, no, it isn't. And why is it has to be about y'all? And why it has to be about talking down to people? We're just having a conversation. We're communicating with each other. If we're community, then we must speak like community. We must communicate like community. But then again, I digress, because what do I know? I'm just a guy that press buttons physically and evidently emotionally as well, too. So with that said, but if you just love that little rant that I just said, yet again, another reason to donate to this radio station, 212-209-2950, or go to give2wbai.org online. There's hope, but that hope has to happen when we all are doing right by each other. Okay? I'll say no more. It's 2 minutes past 6 p.m. Stay tuned for the evening edition of Democracy Now!, followed by Chris Hedges' report here on WBAI New York. Stay tuned.
This is Democracy Now!
The woke mind virus is basically a form of cultural Marxism. At the end of the day, it's an attack on the truth. And because it's a war on truth, I think we have no choice but to wage a war on woke.
Florida Republican Governor Ron DeSantis has formally launched his presidential campaign. We'll go to Florida to look at his record, including his attacks on workers' rights. Plus, we'll speak to the head of Oxfam International, which says G7 nations collectively owe poor nations in the global south more than $13 trillion in development and climate assistance. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Russia's Wagner Group says it has begun withdrawing from Bakhmut and will transfer control of the devastated Ukrainian city to the Russian army. On Wednesday, Wagner's founder, Yevgeny Prigozhin, said 20,000 of the group's mercenaries were killed during Russia's months-long assault on Bakhmut. Prigozhin also warned the invasion of Ukraine could trigger a revolution in Russia, blasting what he called the fat, carefree lives of Russia's elite, while poor and working-class Russians died by the thousands. On Wednesday, the commander of a self-described anti-Putin Russian militia spoke to reporters on the Ukrainian side of the border, promising more attacks on Russian territory after the Kremlin said it had repelled a raid by the militia in the Belgorod region. The New York Times reports the pro-Ukraine fighters used at least three U.S.-made armored vehicles known as MRAPs during their incursion. In Moscow, Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov cited the hardware as evidence of direct involvement in the conflict by the United States and its NATO allies. Earlier today, Russia signed an agreement with Belarus to begin deploying tactical nuclear weapons in the former Soviet state. Meanwhile, Russian Prime Minister Mikhail Mishustin traveled to Shanghai for talks with President Xi Jinping, who said Wednesday cooperation between Moscow and Beijing would reach a higher level. We'll have more on Russia, Belarus, and Ukraine later in the broadcast. In Sudan, bouts of fighting between the army and the paramilitary rapid support forces have been reported in Khartoum and other cities, threatening a fragile 7-day ceasefire. Both sides blame the other for violating the temporary truce, which was mediated by the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. The ongoing fighting has hindered delivery of essential humanitarian relief. As the U.N. says, over 1.3 million people have now fled their homes, about a quarter of them seeking refuge in neighboring countries. Meanwhile, a push by the UN to raise funds for the worsening humanitarian disaster in the Horn of Africa fell far short of its goal, raising just $2.4 billion of the $7 billion needed to respond to the hunger crisis facing millions of people in Somalia, Ethiopia, and Kenya. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres appealed to wealthy nations to step up, saying, quote, people in the Horn of Africa are paying an unconscionable price for a climate crisis they did nothing to cause. Guterres spoke ahead of the UN's pledging event Wednesday.
The longest drought on record, mass displacement after years of conflict and insecurity, skyrocketing food prices, and now chaos and fighting have engulfed Sudan, radiating instability across the entire region.
Typhoon Mawar is headed toward the Philippines and Taiwan after lashing the island of Guam. The powerful storm, which has been upgraded to a super typhoon, downed trees, tore roofs off of houses, and knocked out power across much of the U.S. territory Wednesday, but no fatalities have been reported. Some areas received up to 2 feet of rain. A meteorologist in Guam said of the post-typhoon scene, quote, what used to be a jungle looks like toothpicks. In Germany, police have raided the operations of Direct Action Climate Group Last Generation, targeting 7 locations across the country. Police also froze the group's accounts and shut down their website. The climate activists have been branded a criminal organization due to their high-profile protests, which include shutting down traffic on major roads by gluing themselves to the concrete. Last Generation is one of several direct action groups that have turned to public acts of disruption to draw attention to the spiraling climate disaster. Activists have also shut off pipelines and famously threw mashed potatoes on a painting by Monet in a museum. This is Last Generation member Amy van Baalen speaking after Wednesday's raid.
This doesn't mean that the resistance will stop. We will still continue to resist. We have democratically agreed that we have signed the Paris Agreement. We have a constitution in which Article 20 states that our livelihoods must be preserved today and in the future. And of course, it is absolutely democratic to defend that.
In other climate news, a new investigation from the watchdog group Corporate Accountability finds that over 90% of Chevron's carbon offsets are junk, with some likely contributing to the climate crisis and creating social harm. Environmental and indigenous activists have long opposed the idea of carbon offsets as corporate greenwashing. In related news, the city of Hoboken in New Jersey is suing Chevron, Exxon, and other oil companies over racketeering charges for knowingly deceiving the public of the climate risks of its industry. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said Wednesday the U.S. remains on course to default on its loans as early as next Thursday unless lawmakers agree to raise the ceiling on the national debt. The White House says a default would cause severe damage to the U.S. economy, costing up to 8 million jobs. On Tuesday, far-right House Freedom Caucus member Matt Gaetz openly admitted Republicans were holding the U.S. economy hostage in a bid to force Democrats to agree to huge cuts in federal spending.
I think my conservative colleagues, for the most part, support limit safe growth, and they don't feel like we should negotiate with our hostage.
White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre seized on Gaetz's comments, saying they showed the fight over the debt ceiling was a manufactured crisis.
And don't take our word for it. Just listen to members of the House Freedom Caucus. They've been very honest about this. and are now openly, they're saying the quiet thing out loud, referring to the full faith and credit of the United States as a hostage.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has officially entered the race for the Republican Party's 2024 presidential nomination. DeSantis announced his candidacy during a Twitter Spaces interview with Twitter's billionaire owner Elon Musk. DeSantis' announcement was delayed by a half hour as Twitter's live stream repeatedly glitched and crashed.
There is no substitute for victory. We must end the culture of losing that has infected the Republican Party in recent years. The tired dogmas of the past are inadequate for a vibrant future. We must look forward, not backwards.
As governor of Florida, DeSantis has signed a slew of bills targeting reproductive rights, immigrant rights, public sector unions, the transgender community, and diversity programs in schools. We'll go to Florida after headlines for more on Ron DeSantis' candidacy. Uvalde, Texas has marked the one-year anniversary of the mass shooting that claimed the lives of 19 elementary school children and two of their teachers. Mourners gathered Wednesday outside St. Philip's Episcopal Church for a day of remembrance vigil. San Antonio resident Yolanda Valenzuela says the massacre has caused lasting trauma to teachers, students, and parents across Texas.
Nobody feels safe anymore. The kids, you know, they spend some of their time learning how to deal with active shooters and how to hide and this and that and the other. And 10 years ago, you didn't hear that.
At the White House, President Biden marked the anniversary of the Uvalde massacre with another appeal to Congress to pass a ban on assault weapons and other gun control. In India, the Delhi High Court has summoned the BBC to face a defamation case over a documentary on India's Hindu nationalist Prime Minister Narendra Modi. The film, titled India, The Modi Question, aired earlier this year, highlighting Modi's role in anti-Muslim riots, which killed an estimated 1,000 people in 2002 when Modi was governor of Gujarat state. Modi's government has attempted to block people sharing the film, calling it, quote, hostile propaganda and anti-India garbage. An Australian police officer has been charged over the killing of a 95-year-old great-grandmother in a New South Wales nursing home. Claire Nolan died Wednesday of complications from head trauma after 33-year-old senior police constable Christian White fired his taser at her, causing her to collapse. Officers had been responding to a report of an elderly woman with dementia holding a serrated steak knife. Australian police are allowed to use tasers if they feel their lives are in danger, but witnesses say Nolan weighed 95 pounds and was slowly advancing toward officers using a walker. New South Wales Police Commissioner Karen Webb announced the charges Wednesday.
For the offences of recklessly inflict grievous bodily harm, assault occasioning actual bodily harm, and assault.
Here in New York, resident doctors at Elmhurst Hospital in Queens have ended their strike after reaching a tentative deal with their employer, the Mount Sinai Health System. Their union says the agreement brings early career doctors much closer towards parity with their counterparts who work at hospitals in Manhattan. And the queen of rock and roll, Tina Turner, has died at the age of 83. Born Anna Mae Bullock in Tennessee, she rose to fame alongside her husband, Ike Turner, in the 1960s before leaving the abusive relationship and becoming a solo artist. Turner topped the charts with hits like What's Love Got to Do with It, The Best, and Proud Mary. She won 8 Grammys throughout her career and was celebrated for her electrifying stage performances. Like many notable black artists, Tina Turner faced racism in the U.S. and said she felt more at home in Europe, where she had an even larger fan base. She lived with her husband, Erwin Bach, in Switzerland, where she passed away peacefully after a battle with intestinal cancer. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Amy is at her nephew's college graduation. Florida's Republican Governor Ron DeSantis has officially launched his presidential campaign. DeSantis made the announcement on a Twitter audio stream hosted by Twitter's billionaire owner Elon Musk, but major technical glitches disrupted the event. DeSantis later appeared on Fox News.
The woke mind virus is basically a form of cultural Marxism. At the end of the day, it's an attack on the truth. And because it's a war on truth, I think we have no choice but to wage a war on woke. So how does that work for a president? Some of it may be the bully pulpit, being willing to tell the truth and not being deluded by ideology, which we see in many aspects of our society.
The 2024 Republican primaries will pit DeSantis against his former ally Donald Trump and at least five other Republicans, including Senator Tim Scott and former UN Ambassador Nikki Haley. As governor of Florida, DeSantis has passed a slew of bills targeting reproductive rights, immigrant rights, the transgender community, and diversity programs in schools. He's also recently signed legislation to weaken the power of public sector unions. To talk more about Ron DeSantis, we're joined by Alfonso Mayfield. He's the president of SEIU, Florida Public Services Union. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Alfonso Mayfield. If you could begin by responding to the announcement by Ron DeSantis.
I think it's just the use of words. That he didn't really say anything. I think a lot of his governing strategy has been to throw out firebrand cultural issues because he does not have actual policy-based solutions to the ills of what are happening to the people of Florida.
And could you explain, Alfonso, what exactly is happening to the people of Florida? What are the issues that they're confronting?
Skyrocketing rents, skyrocketing home prices. Our schools are to some extent falling apart because of years of lack of funding and a move to privatize public education, which he pushed for last cycle. Skyrocketing energy prices. He has approved and pushed for multiple increases or the allowing of multiple increases of energy prices over the last few years. So people are hurting. The cost of inflation is not keeping up with people's wages. And instead of dealing with those issues directly, he's punching down and focusing on the most marginalized aspects of our community and the people who are actually working and trying to create a better life for their families and their communities.
Well, to go to that, earlier this month, as we said in our introduction, DeSantis signed legislation aimed at weakening public sector unions. Could you explain what that legislation entails and also why unions representing police, firefighters, and corrections officers were exempt from the bill?
So I'll start with the latter first. I think that it was done for two reasons. The exemption was to divide workers, and it was also for him to cater to a core part of his base, which are more people who are in more conservative aspects of the labor movement, and he did not want to appear publicly that he was attacking fire and police. His reasons for doing it, you look at who's funding his campaign or who's giving him campaign contributions, I think that's fairly obvious. But what the attack essentially does was it basically tries to put up significant barriers between workers and their ability to be able to have a union. It puts their contracts at risk by saying that there has to be a 60% threshold for membership for them to be able to keep their contracts. And it adds a bunch of, you know, crazy auditing requirements to prove that people who say that they're members of the union are member of the unions, and also a 40-page membership card. It's doing what far-right conservatives complain about all the time, of using the power of the state and using what he said, the bully pulpit of regulation to be able to try to interfere with people's daily life. It's actually doing that. It's an attempt to soften flat out stifle the voice of workers, but it's not going to work. Other members of labor are committed to making sure that that doesn't happen.
And Alfonso, could you elaborate, who are the workers that are principally impacted or will be principally impacted by these policies?
That's a great question. So it's all workers who work in the public sector with an exemption for fire and police. So I know that there was a narrative push that this was just about teachers, which was also still horrible, but this would affect everyone who is a public employee in Florida, on the state level, on the local level. So everyone from school teachers, bus drivers, custodians, adjunct professors, sanitation workers, if you code enforcement, if you work in the public sector, you would be impacted by the passing of this law.
And so could you give us overall, Alfonso, a record of what his tenure has been like as governor and what you fear the impact on workers across the country would be in the event that he's elected president?
It has been governing by distraction. It's been governing by punching down, not having solutions to actual problems and using jargon and catchphrases as a distraction. It has been focusing on workers, people of color, immigrants, and the LGBTQ community, and saying, look at these people, they're the reason for all the problems, while actually passing bills and pushing for the passage of bills that are making the lives of Floridians worse. You will be hard pressed to find anyone, right, left, center, that would say that Floridians are better off than they were when he took office. And he knows that. And so if he becomes president, you're also looking at someone who would have the temerity and the ability to use the full power of the state to silence vast swaths of voices on both sides of the aisle, because it's all about power and control.
And finally, Alfonso, do you think Florida is still a swing state? Can Democrats not win a statewide race there?
Florida is absolutely a swing state. And I want to dispel some myths about last cycle in Florida. Florida suffered a 90% drop of investment in campaigns over the election in 18. What that means is that the national party, national apparatuses, other donors basically said, we're not going to put money in Florida, in part because of saving the House and other factors. So when you have someone on one side that's spending presidential level money and still did not get the level of turnout that they did in 18, and one side does not have the resources, this is what happens. I think that there's a reckoning that's coming within our democracy. A friend of mine, Eric Bracken, talks a lot of, and he stole this quote, but I'm gonna give him credit for it, that to keep the democracy, we have to win in the Midwest. And he, but he also talks about how the Confederacy has always undermined the democracy. We have to be able to do both. We can't cede half the country and think that we're gonna keep a functioning democracy. Every race where resources were plentiful and existed, we won or were competitive. If we want to be competitive in Florida, we have to invest. But all the indicators show Florida's still a swing state.
Thank you so much, Alfonso Mayfield, president of SEIU, Florida Public Services Union. We end today's show with a new Oxfam report that shows G7 countries collectively owe poor nations in the global south more than $13 trillion in development and climate assistance. But instead, these countries are saddled with daily debt repayments of $232 million, deepening the global chasm of inequality. To talk more about this, we go now to New Delhi, India, where we're joined by Amitabh Behar, Interim Executive Director of Oxfam International. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Amitabh Behar. If you could lay out what this report found, the Oxfam report.
The report is essentially talking about how we need to really relook at the narrative. The current narrative where we talk of G7 as these charitable global leaders, which actually should be getting resources in terms of debt repayment from the low and middle income countries, needs to be completely transformed. You know, we need to change the gaze. The gaze is essentially where we need to look at what do the G7 countries owe to the to the poor in the middle-income countries. So I think that change is critical. And as you said, our report clearly says that the G7 countries owe $13.3 trillion to the low and middle income countries. So, that's massive. So this is in the form of the non-payment of aid and not putting resources in climate action. So that's really the story. And when the G7 is met in Hiroshima, they were talking about zero hunger, they were talking of climate action, but they did not really look at what their responsibility is.
And Amitabh, if you could elaborate on that, you've said the huge costs from climate damage caused by the, quote, reckless burning of fossil fuels by rich countries needs to be addressed here as part of the debt. What are you calling for?
If you look at the commitments that were made by G7, they said from 22 to 25, they were going to invest $100 billion every year. And we've not really seen that money come. And if you increasingly look at the massive damages happening because of the climate crisis, particularly in the South, somebody needs to take responsibility for that. And it's fairly clear, report after report, that the G7 countries are significantly responsible for these emissions. And at this moment, as our report says, that they almost owe $8.7 trillion in terms of loss and damages. So that's something that must be put up front by the G7 countries, but that's not happening. And then the second part is that in 1970, the G7 countries agreed to a 0.7 of GNI as ODA. But we have still now not even seen half of that money getting realized. So there are massive shortfalls, deficits in terms of the money that G7 owes to the developing countries.
And Amitabh Bihar, if you could explain what the concrete effects of these crippling debt payments are on the global South. This comes as a global hunger crisis has risen for the fifth consecutive year. Talk about the impact on individual states of these debt repayments and where the money is taken from to repay the debt.
Absolutely. I think that's also very central to our report, that the 230 million that goes out every day in terms of debt repayment, which is going to go to the coffers of the G7 countries and also a lot of rich bankers, is essentially the money that could have been invested in education, in health, in gender justice programs, in ensuring safe drinking water, in climate resilience. But that's the money that's going back to the G7 countries. And this is happening in the context of the poly crisis that we are witnessing. As you said, fifth year, we are seeing in a row where hunger is rising. Almost 280 million plus people sleep hungry every night. And this is the time when this whole debt crisis is being talked of. And you know, this is also in that context of the fuel crisis. You're looking at inflation. So even the cost of debt repayment is going higher as the dollar cost goes up. So in the context of the poly crisis, this is really hypocrisy to say that G7 is taking global leadership while it's the schools and the public health system, safe drinking water, which is getting taken away from the poor and the excluded communities.
And Amitabh, we have just 30 seconds. If you could say how humanitarian aid fits into it, the inadequacy of it, and what needs to be done.
It's extremely inadequate. It's fairly clear that the need for humanitarian aid is just growing. And that's growing because what we're looking at, you know, the poly crisis is also in terms of inequality, the climate crisis, conflicts. These are all coming together. And at this juncture, the humanitarian aid is galloping in terms of the need manyfold but the commitments are very, very hollow.
So I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Amitabh Behar, Interim Executive Director of Oxfam International, speaking to us from Delhi. And that does it for its show. I'm Amy Goodman. I'm Nermeen.
Now you talk about terror.
Welcome to another podcast from the Chris Hedges Report.
What about for me?
I'm Chris Hedges, and you can find more of my work at chrishedges.substack.com.